I was working, I'd started a not-for-profit by that stage, and we'd started using the term deaf literacy in our community work. And but this is like 14 years ago, Sian. So, it's like, ages ago. And people were, or we found that, a lot of people, a lot of health professionals were like, oh, that's a weird term. Oh, we don't like that. Why do you call it that? But community got it. Community were like, yes, wow, awesome, that's it.
That was Dr. Kerry Noonan, clinical psychologist and social researcher from Australia. We talk about death and grief literacy in Australia and around the world, what it is, why it's important, and how it is really a community endeavor.
Hi, I'm Xian Xiao.
And I'm Sammy Winemaker. We talk to people who have information and tips on how to unlock a better illness experience.
The waiting room revolution starts right now.
Okay, so Kerry, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm so excited because you are joining us from Australia, and I'd love to know where you're located in Australia.
Well, I live in Dubbo, which is about 5 hours west of Sydney. We are a kind of feeder town in rural, regional New South Wales. The LHD that I work in, the local health district that I work in here, it covers about I think a third of the state. So it's a really big regional area.
Amazing. And you are on a mission to create a more deaf literate society. So can you tell our audience what is deaf literacy and what got you interested in studying this?
Yeah, such a good question. So, well, I'll start with the studying bit first, because we were doing, myself and some researchers at Western Sydney University, we were doing some research looking at the role that caring networks have at end of life. So we weren't focused on the dying person, we were focused on their carers and caregivers. And that was quite unique at the time. And we wanted to kind of understand, how did networks kind of change over time? What did they do? How did they support each other? And we used a mixed methods approach. So we did social network analysis, looking at like the way that networks formed. And we also gave people cameras back in the day when disposable cameras were still around and no one had a camera on their phone. So that's kind of funny. So we would send out disposable cameras to everyone. They would take photos, and the photos were a way to help people talk about caring, because in Australia, if you ask people, how do you help? What do you do to care? They say nothing. I really didn't do anything. So instead, we got a whole heap of photos, and we had these big focus groups with whole caring networks, sometimes as big as 20, where people would look at the photos and share stories about what they did. And it was just incredible and really beautiful. And so we were analyzing all of that data, and we were trying to find a way to name a theme that had kind of come from the data. And it was this theme about people learnt stuff. People talked about how they learnt stuff about death and dying. They learned about that you could care at home. They didn't know that before. They learnt that you could die at home. They didn't know that before. And then we took the study even further, and we started looking at the outer networks as well, not just the people doing the hands-on care. And we found the same things there. People talked about the learning and the experiences. So that's not to say that it also wasn't hard. I'm not trying to glorify caring. We know how hard that is and how challenging it can be. But this information kind of came from the stories and was really present in the data. So anyway, we were trying to find a way to name this theme, and I started looking at the health literacy data, and I started looking at the critical health literacy data, and still it wasn't quite right. And one day One day we were in a meeting and I'd written down death literacy. This is death literacy, not health literacy. And then I started making an argument, you know, for the team about why we should call it death literacy, not health literacy, and had kind of created a little bit of a table. And anyway, we started having this conversation and we just went, yeah, that's it. That's it.
Wow. So that's how the term death literacy came about.
So that death literacy kind of grew out of that. And then we did some more research and kind of followed that up. But then, you know, I was working, I'd started a not-for-profit by that stage, and we'd started using the term death literacy in our community work. And, but this is like 14 years ago, Sian. So, you know, it's like, you know, ages ago, and people were, or we found that, you know, a lot of people, a lot of health professionals were like, oh, that's a weird term. Oh, we don't like that. Why do you call it that? But community got it. Community were like, yes, wow, awesome. That's it. And so then, yeah, we just kind of started talking about it and putting it out there. And then we created an awareness day around it and all kinds of stuff. So that's a really long way to answer your question, but basically death literacy is our know-how about death, dying, loss, and grief. That's how I like to think about it. That's the simplest kind of way to put it. And I like to think about it as four things, and I use the acronym SEEK, S-E-A-K, skills, experiences, actions and attitudes, and knowledge. And those four things from the work that we've been doing with the index that we've since developed, that those four things seem to be kind of standing up cross-culturally. We've now got the index being validated in China, Turkey, UK, Taiwan, and other places. So it's really very interesting, actually.
That was one of my questions. This index, the death literacy index, like yes. You mentioned the four parts of it, but is this what is it and how are you using it?
Yeah, so it really came, it was quite a pragmatic kind of decision because we were doing compassionate communities work at the time, and we were saying death literacy really is an outcome of compassionate communities. Yet it was hard to kind of, it's always difficult with community work because we also have to show kind of these hard outcomes. Soft outcomes are much more exciting and interesting and, you know, juicy and real and full of story, storyful. But there's also this pragmatic need to show that compassionate communities does create the changes that we say it does. So that's where the index came out from, and we decided that we went for a grant, we got the grant, that was amazing, and then we worked for a couple of years on getting the tool right and validating it, publishing it, and so on. But it was really that pragmatic need.
How are you using it? So does a community rank itself on certain questions, or is it done by an individual? Like, can you give us an example? Yeah.
So what we did is we decided to set it up as like an index and benchmark kind of populations. So that way it could still be used as a valid kind of community tool. So we have national benchmarks in Australia for death literacy, for example. So that's kind of, you know, that satisfies that nerdy need to quantify things. Uh-huh. So what communities do and what community groups do is, say you've got a group of 20 people, you do it as a group, mm-hmm. and you talk about how did you do as a group, maybe compared to the national benchmarks. Are we doing better or worse than the rest of Australia? What are our strengths? What are our challenges? What can we look at? It provides community don't care about all these words and stuff like this. So when I talk about this, I'm not talking, this is not how community members, of course, sit around and talk about it. But, you know, what happens is it provides an evidence-based response to need in the community if people want to do that. So people can say, we're not doing so well on knowledge. What could we do in our community to develop knowledge more? What would that look like? How would that be? Who are our knowledge holders? How can we bring them to life? And so on. In the other way that community members are using it is simply as a kind of I'd like to see more gamification of it. More play with it. So you know, I've seen people do all kinds of creative things because, you know, a survey is actually quite a creative way to measure things if it's not on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So you can use ping pong balls or stones and tools to kind of measure size and length and amount and stuff like that. And, you know, the index itself kind of creates a lot of conversations because of the questions that are in there. So, you know, you can sort cards, you can sort categories, you can think about where we think we are at the moment, where we'd like to be and move things around. Yeah, there are lots of interesting things happening out there.
Yeah, you know, when you're saying that, it makes me think, I think there's this commercial, right, of how you measure retirement or the value of life or something. And there's these community art projects, I'll call them, to visualize these concepts that are really numerical, but really in a way that engages people. And I think you did some of this. I was reading about the Groundswell Project, which, if I'm not mistaken, is sort of a whole series of arts-based and community collaborations and people talking about these issues in different ways. So can you give us some examples from that project so people can maybe understand better?
Well, one of the first things we did, so I had the great privilege of kind of meeting my co-founder, Peter Murray, who's an artist, producer, I had the great privilege of meeting my founder of Groundswell, Peter Murray, who's an artist. She's a writer and theatre producer. And so I had found out about some of the work, the arts programs that were happening at St. Christopher's Hospice in the UK. And they mentored us actually for a good year. It was amazing. And what came out of that was we went into a school and we brought people who with motor neuron disease and their carers into the school, and over a kind of whole series of meetings started theatre making with the year 11 kids. So year 11 in Australia is like 15, 16 year olds. So, and that just so happens that in year 11, you have to create, you have to build some theatre, you have to write it, perform it, and so on. So with the care, with people with MND and their carers and these young people, we just went through a series of kind of play building experiences. It was really cool. And so what we did is, yeah, we did all kinds of creative things, but we set the scene. So, you know, We had some rules. Our rules were you can ask, because what we would do is set up a series of conversations between the people with MND and their carers and the kids. So what we didn't want to do is traditional health education. I don't know what it's like in Canada, but if you've got an issue, you bring the health educators in, they talk, they give out some T-shirts, and then they leave. So we wanted the young people to really like embody it. So like that's death literacy on steroids, right? You want people to embody the experience. And so these young people had the opportunity to ask questions with people who are dying and their carers and also learn about MND. And then they built theatre together. They did, like they actually built theatre together. It was so amazing. And then the kids worked with Peter as a professional playwright to develop a broader piece that was like 8 minutes long. And And so the kids, and we would of course evaluate that, and the people with MND and their carers were like, we weren't really sure what we were doing or why we were coming here. And the kids and the young people were like, this like changed my life. Like I was gonna do this and now I want to be a doctor, or now I want to be an OT, an occupational therapist, because actually this is I've learned so much. So it was really interesting. And then we did that for another 5 years, and then the school and the teacher kind of took it on and did it in their own work. So this was an example of that. We weren't trying to change the curriculum. So there's a lot of talk about death education in schools, and we've got to change the curriculum to kind of come up with death education. And I think that's valid, that's fine. But we also, we what our learning was out of this was that actually death already exists in the curriculum, in science, in theatre, in English. Death, dying, loss, and grief is there. It's already there. And so as people who are interested in developing death literacy, we need to find creative vehicles, meaningful, contextual vehicles for people to engage with the topic. And this was how we did that with young people.
Oh, that's amazing. I know that was many years ago, but the idea of combining arts, culture, death and dying, and all normalizing it through storytelling, I mean, I think that's just so cool. And really, it's a movement that can empower a community. And that's a nice segue into what I know is your current research, the idea of compassionate communities. So, can you tell the audience what is a compassionate community?
Yeah, I mean, like this is the formal definition. People can go and Google kind of the more nerdy formal definition. But for me, it's around, I'll just use plain language, which is the way informal communities, connected people come together to support someone when there's a need. So it might be around a death, or it might be around bereavement, or it could be around a flood or a fire or a natural disaster. So there are lots of naturally occurring compassionate communities that help each other. We saw that during COVID, neighbors, people coming together naturally to do things together to support each other. What compassionate communities does is really kind of tap into that natural instinct to support each other. And it might, then, if there might be a more kind of structured way, I guess, to kind of bring people together around a topic or an issue. So a lot of the compassionate communities work, I think, is doing a combination of both, bringing communities together that are pre-existing and already maybe loosely connected to come together for some greater experience of caring in their community. And other compassionate communities programs are kind of almost starting from scratch, kind of going, okay, so how could we do more of this around here? Whereas other like people are, whereas in a kind of more formal network, those of us like community development workers or other kind of organizations are kind of coming together to really see how they can build networks and build connections that maybe weren't there before. So I think there's kind of both ends of the spectrum. There's definitely both ends of the spectrum. And it's really about bringing to life those strengths in the community, which I think is very exciting because they're the stories that we don't kind of hear really potentially.
You know, I love the work you do with compassionate communities because it emphasizes that the care of a person and their family is not only done in doctor's offices or hospitals or the formal health system, but really it's done by the community.
And there's also, so I would say the other thing about compassionate communities work is looking at that public health model and really, so for health professionals, the challenge is how do I reorientate the practices that we have towards community not only for service delivery, but beyond service delivery. And, you know, a lot of people in the compassionate community space, we talk about the 95% rule. So this idea that 5% of the time we are with health professionals and care providers who are kind of from formal services who come to us. And 95% of the time we're either on our own or we're with family or we're watching the telly or on the internet or, you know, we're in our communities. So, and apparently that number stands up even when you're sitting in hospital. So even when you're there, you know, it's only about 5% of the time that the nurse is coming in and kind of giving you meds or the doctors come around for their daily visit. So that it's that 95% that compassionate communities are trying to, strengthen and build. So it's not an either or. The health professionals and professional care is a really important part of that. But it acknowledges the bigger part is actually our connection with family, friends, and community.
Yeah, I love that. Hey, listeners, you're halfway through the episode. We want to remind you that our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, is available anywhere you buy books. Did you know you can leave a review on Amazon without purchasing directly from Amazon? All you need is an account. Reviews help others find our book when they need it most. Thanks for your support, and lots more of this great episode left, so keep listening. And so you did a really nice job explaining what they are and why they're so important. I'm curious to know, what are some of the research projects and questions you have about compassionate communities?
What I know is that if we give people experiences, or if people have experiences and they have the opportunity to reflect on those experiences in a helpful way, their death literacy improves. And we know that if death literacy improves, that people get better at helping others, or can potentially, it's the social capital of death literacy, I think. You know, people can then potentially be the supporter or the carer for others. But one of the things we've been looking at is kind of some more traditional education type work. So we've been doing a grief literacy program, which kind of grew during COVID. So my colleagues in Kerala had a chat to me about some of the stuff they were noticing in Kerala that COVID was doing for their natural caring networks after bereavement. So with everyone unable to kind of do funeral and death rituals and the other things that would happen, there was a change in grief. And you know, the guys in Kerala at the Institute of Palliative Medicine, Suresh Kumar, Saif Muhammad, they were, and others, they were, they're on the ground, you know, they're on the ground and noticing, and people are telling them this. So we started meeting, and we started, they said, can we develop a program? And I was like, well, I can support you to do that, but I can't speak Malayalam, and I wouldn't even want to design anything or without kind of understanding the context. So of course, action people that they are in Kerala. So we ran a series of focus groups then that helped kind of inform and build a program around grief literacy in the community. So, and it was this beautiful kind of COVID experience, really. We're all on Zoom. They're all in Kerala on Zoom. I'm in Dubbo on my Zoom. I've got translators. I've got texting translators happening. We're all talking. We come up with a program, and then we start running the program. So then people seem to like the program. We redevelop the program. We kind of tweak it a bit, and we get feedback, and we, you know, keep doing that kind of co-design iteration. Yes. And everything. Well, not pure co-design, can I say, though. It's not what you would call co-design, but definitely developed together. So then we ran it in Bangladesh, Then we ran it in Thailand. Then we ran it in the Philippines. And we started running it in Australia as well. And we've just done our first evaluation on how effective has it been across the world. And we found that it has been. People, you know, over 80% of people said that their grief literacy improved. We've got some neat little pre-post testing that we've done to satisfy the nerdiness of it all.
So we've been talking about death literacy and grief literacy education programs, which are gaining traction in many countries. And I bet a lot of that has to do with the fact that you're a psychologist and you have a lot of knowledge about education theory and behavior change. And so these programs are very effective. But I'm curious, how did you take theory, say about grief, and move that into action so that it can actually benefit people?
The theory, people, I was really interested by the fact that people love the theory aspects, because what we do in that little part of the training or the program is we challenge some of the stages of grief. And sometimes, well, many times actually, people have only got that model in their head and I would say in their body with grief. You know, grief is such a full-bodied experience. So we really try and educate, provide some pointers around kind of grief being that full-bodied experience. And it'll be different for everyone, but it's not just these five discrete stages. And that's a revelation for people many times. And we talk about the tier model, the tasks of grief model. We mess with it a little, sorry, Warden. We've changed the tasks of grief to the helpers of grief. And that really like actually changes the way you think about those tasks because they're helpers. These are the things that are helpers, facilitators of healthy grief. And that's cool. People are like, yes.
No. Yeah. So you tweak the language to make it more actionable. That's kind of like what we did to change the language of palliative care in the waiting room revolution, right? You changed the language a bit too, from tasks of grief to helpers of grief. And so I guess as a follow-up, you know, what has the impact of that been?
So accepting the reality of the loss, for example. So that's if you think about that as a task, it's like, my task is to, and I know that's not what Warden's saying, but when you hear the word task, people go, well, this is my task to accept the reality of the loss. But when we change it to a helper, it helps to have opportunities to accept the reality of the loss. That turns into actions. So what that then becomes is, we talked a lot about, especially during COVID, that at the moment, if you're not getting to see the person who died, then it's really hard. If that's a disruption to a cultural and a cultural ritual and a cultural norm, then it can actually it can be difficult to accept the reality. If that's what you always do, is see the dead person after as part of grief, as part of ritual. So if we change it to a helper, then people go, oh, this helps. It helps to have opportunities to do things that help us accept. And that might mean talking more with each other, just telling stories more with each other, you know, having opportunities to cry, having opportunities to not cry, whatever it might be. But yeah, so we've messed with that a little. But people really love it. They really love the theoretical aspects of it. And that really has surprised me a bit. But it also goes to show that people are thinking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. People actually are trying to make sense of the experience of grief and make sense of the experience of dying and caregiving.
So you've mentioned a few times this idea about language and how it's framed and turning things into action. And that's a nice segue into what Sammy and I are trying to do in this waiting room revolution. I mean, we realized that very clearly that this idea of palliative care to the general public is scary or can be scary. They associate it very much with death and dying. And for patients and families, that's something they're really you know, fighting against in some ways, for better or for worse. So this idea of fighting against it. So I think what we have learned is by reframing the actions that they can take early in an illness, which is really about being as informed as they want to be, as they can be, about the natural history of their illness and the things that the many people before wish they had known and can prepare for, leads to better outcomes, leads to a healthier grieving and anticipatory grief and things like that. So I guess I'm just, from what you understand, or I'm happy to talk more, but what's your sense of the waiting room revolution and death literacy?
Well, I think what you talk, to me, it's death, what you're talking about is death literacy. It is that reframe on I'm a passive participant kind of rolling through this series of silos and different health professionals and whatever, needs to be reframed. I think anything that we do to help people to kind of see when actually they are active participants. So I've got to say, that's to me also in some of the research work that we've done, we found that the people often incredibly active in their caring and dying journey, but it's often seen by the system as defiance or being obstructive or patient. That's been our research here, some of our research here in Australia. It's kind of like the difficult patients. My challenge always to people, to systems, is are we ready for death literate people? So that would be so what you're saying is like, I just relate to it so much, and I love the work that you guys are doing around that, and how it really kind of helps people to think about what they can do to be active and participate and engaged in the journey, the experience that they're on. And I would also say that we also need to think about how the system responds to those people, because, and I try to, in talks that I do, challenge our systems and health professionals when it's appropriate and say, how are we ready for these death literate people? Because they're the ones who are going to come in and go, well, I don't want to die in the hospital. I want to die at home. Yes, I know I don't have any carers, but I've got neighbours. And yes, the system's just going to have to get used to that, because my neighbours are my people. Things like, you know, if I die in the hospital, I want my family to take my body home. How are the systems ready for these potential disruptions to service, ordinary service delivery? That to me is the big policy bit that is going to need to follow in the systems. I think actually maybe the systems forget that we're creating this kind of army of informed people that are going to be on their doorstep. Like, I'm not going to be a very happy camper if I'm dying and the system won't budge around what I need or want from them.
Yeah, it's true. People have talked about the different generations and how the needs and expectations are different. But what you talked about is exactly what some of the feedback we've had from people who have read our book and listened to our podcast and tried to enact some of the actions. And we talk about Sammy and I talk about the B side, which is, you know, activating clinicians and healthcare providers and people in the system to be able to respond and sort of building the bridge there so they're ready for it. But what has your experience been, or what advice do you have for people who are trying to be activated and come up against a system where there are some barriers?
Yeah, I think what you were saying before and some of the work that you're doing is helpful. So, like, try and know the system. So death literate people kind of do have more system knowledge, actually, and you get that usually by experience. So, you know, you've done it with an aunt or a friend or whatever. So you've seen it happen. So you know what to expect. So try and have experiences of the system before you actually need them would be one thing. Well, that's a little kind of vague. But some people I know are this is how they're utilizing death doulas or end-of-life doulas in the system because they're impartial and not part of the system. And I think that is a challenging thing for institutions to manage and deal with, but have someone have like you know everyone we often say everyone's got a nurse in their family. Get them, find them, find your nurse in your family and bring them with you to an appointment if you know that you're going to be talking about something that's a bit salty or a bit difficult with the system. Ask questions when you go at your first admission. Ask, can my family sleep here? I've got, 10 people who I know who are going to want to be with me when I die. Are they all going to be able to come and be with me? What are your rules about that? What happens after I die? Do you have a mortuary on site? If that's important to you, obviously, that to me, I'm always stretching into the death care, always beyond. Because and so ask about that if that's important to you, and yeah, get be as informed as you can. Talk to the nurses about what it's like around here. Talk to other patients about what they're doing and the care that they're receiving. And I think no, being prepared means it's tough. It means thinking about what those last days or weeks are going to be like. And so, it's not only the thinking about, though, you've got to do the next step. And this next step is really hard to do when you're dying and you don't have a lot of energy. So do it as soon as you can. And that is the talking with the people who matter about what your plans are. And that's a really tough step, but don't leave it till the time where you've hardly got any energy. It's not going to be a priority then because of how much energy dying can take for some people.
I feel like everything you've said about death literacy is about this idea that as mortal beings, there will come a time when we need to face that what is important to us, what is our legacy, what do we want to say to the people that matter to us, who are the people that matter to us. These are all the things that we can actively think about earlier on, and like you said, don't wait till the end. So that's what we're trying to do too, but I think everything you're saying is connected to that. So I wanted
And
to just, yeah, go ahead, go ahead.
that just reminded me of a comment that one of the participants in the student workshop said, and that was, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, I thought that I didn't really understand what contribution I would make. I thought, what am I going to do here? This is a theatre project. I'm a person who's got MND. But actually, they by the end of the program, they had a really strong sense of the contribution they could make, not only in the lives of the kids, but actually, after that person died. The family talked with us a lot about what the program had meant to them and that ability to contribute and give back and participate. And I think it takes a lot of, I reflected on that because of what you were saying about, we've got all these, well, none of us know how many months and years we've got left, whether we've got a terminal illness or not. And I really, really resonate with that idea of actively thinking about how do I want these months and years to be. If you know about your treatments and you know about how those treatments might impact on you, if you know about, you know, what's coming for you in terms of the way an illness might change, then you can really make informed decisions about all those well months and years. So,
We've been talking about death literacy, and we actually met at a conference, an international conference about advanced care planning. So, I'd love to hear a little bit about what the connection between what your work is and this idea of advanced care planning, which I think, you know, many people listening might might have different ideas of what that means.
I think we're still learning about that in terms of the research side of things. But I mean, for me, the advanced care planning is all of that stuff we've been talking about, the conversations, the learning, the understanding of your illness, the thinking about kind of, you know, what are the next couple of years? How well do I want to live? That, to me, that is the awesomeness about advanced care planning, being able to really bring all of that to life. And people don't often the focus is on getting the piece of paper written, signed off. And to me, that's just in some ways almost like the blip in the middle, because you've got to kind of understand a lot about your illness and about what's happening, and have conversations with your doctors and the people to make informed decisions, the people in your life to make informed decisions. And then you might sign a document that helps kind of outline how you want your wishes to be enacted. But then the next bit comes. You've got to tell all the people and kind of, you know, live as if. In terms of death literacy, what we do know, and we've just got some more data about death literacy here in Australia, and I can talk about that a little bit more if you like, in general terms, but death literacy was only moderately related to having an advanced care plan. And certainly at the International Advanced Care Planning Conference, Sian, remember, I don't know if you remember, I presented the data on the number of people in the audience who had their advanced care plan. It was like 50%. So I think, you know, that's higher than the average, but still at an International Advanced Care Planning Conference, there were still kind of, you know, not a lot of people doing them. So anyway, we're still learning about the connection between death literacy and advanced care planning. That reminds me of some community work that we did with a group, 55 plus group, and really educated group of people. We had over 800 responses to the death literacy index. And so we could really look at their death literacy and look at all the planning that they'd done. So a really high percentage had done all their planning, advanced care plan. They talked about it with their families. They'd signed the forms, you know, got the directive, all of that. However, like 10% had spoken to their doctors about their plan. So interesting. Mm-hmm. So you know, advanced care planning is a really important thing, I think, for all the social, practical learning experiences. I think we've still got more to learn about what it means in terms of care outcomes and what it means practically, but it seems to be an important part of death literacy, but we're still learning.
I'm just looking at the time. We have a little bit left, but I have a question for you. This is sort of a personal question, but for myself, but you know, you've done a lot of research and talking with community. What is your experience with this idea of there are some people who there's an older generation where
you know, the people caring for them are too scared, need to protect them, and want that to avoid telling them this bad news that they may be sick or that a loved one has died. And so they would rather, pretend, you know, keep a secret, I guess, and avoid telling them. How does that fit with this idea of people's resilience, people's attitudes about death, dying, grief, and loss? What's your experience been?
I think it's really natural to protect people. And I think, yeah, it's understandable. My experience working in palliative care was that most people knew that, in fact, what many times what was happening was a kind of protection racket between the person with the illness and the family, and sometimes the health professionals too. I think it does add some stress to the system, and some anxiety to the system, because whenever you keep secrets in a system, a family system, a work system, a health system, secrets cause anxiety because there's this unspoken thing sitting in the room with people and systems. And yeah, we don't do well with that as humans. So I think so what to do about that? Your question is kind of, what about that? I think that all we can do is really support people and be deeply respectful of the choices that they're making as a family around that. One thing that I would do, though, as a health professional, is ask about family values. So I know I'm flipping hats here a little bit, but as a clinician working with stigma or secrets or something that's hidden in the system, what I gravitate towards is kind of asking the family about how they lived their lives in terms of what are their family values, what's important to them. And, you know, trust and shame and things like that usually kind of come up in those conversations. So I would lean into that a little bit and kind of explore that and explore what that means. Not to necessarily take someone then into, you know, oh, well, what about this big secret you're keeping from Nan? But to kind of explore it really in a way to help them to acknowledge some of that unspoken anxiety that's in the room. Mm-hmm. So that's what I tend to do with that. And I've had a few times, of course, where people have said to me, look, I know that I'm dying. I know that it's hard for my family. And I would ask about that. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean? What do you want to do about that? You know, so.
Yeah. Carrie, we've learned so much. We like to end some of our interviews with, what gives you hope? What are you excited about for the future?
So many things. There's so much work happening in this space at the moment. It's very exciting. I feel like we're on the tail end of some big work that has happened, and it feels like we're transitioning into like another phase of work around compassionate communities and death literacy and kind of caring for people and thinking about how we support each other. I think off the tail end of COVID as well, people, you know, there was a lot of fatigue post-COVID, and I think some of that is still there, but it has kind of created some deep questioning about how quickly we can do things. That's one thing. Like, we can change policy overnight if we need to. Wow, who knew? And also it questions around how we care for each other as health professionals and how we support each other in communities. And I think I think we're going to see some really fantastic innovative work over the next kind of 10 years. And Yeah, it's going to be exciting. I'm excited.
Me too. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Visit our website, waitingroomrevolution.com, for more information, to join our newsletter, and to check out our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest. This podcast is produced by myself, Kayla McMillan, Shilpa Jyothi Kumar, and Maggie Sivek. And our theme music is Maypole by Ketza.